Judges 10:17 down to 11:11. Our title for today, Jobs for Bad Boys. Quite appropriate as I look around. When the Ammonites were called to arms and camped in Gilead, the Israelites assembled and camped at Mizpah. And the leaders of the people of Gilead said to each other, "Whoever will launch the attack against the Ammonites will be the head of all those living in Gilead." And Jephthah, he was the Gilead. He was a mighty warrior. In fact, his father's name was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. And Gilead's wife also bore him other sons. And when these sons were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. They said, "You are not going to get any inheritance in our family, because you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tob, a land where a group of adventurers gathered around him and followed him. Sometime later, when the Ammonites made war on Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. "Come," they said, "be our commander so we can fight the Ammonites." And Jephthah said to them, "Didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble?" And the elders of Gilead said to him, "Well, nevertheless, we are turning to you now. Come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be our head over all who live in Gilead." And Jephthah answered, "Suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites and the Lord gives them to me. Will I really be your head?" And the elders replied, "The Lord is our witness. We will certainly do as you say." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And he repeated all his words before them in Mizpah. Jobs for bad boys. We're looking at this in a situation, there's a crisis in Israel. But there's a job vacancy come up. And I'm thinking about this today, it's like the Westerns. Now, I mentioned Westerns last week. And some of you may have done your homework and watched a Western. Right? But you know the deal. There's a town. And there are these bad guys terrorizing the town. They're robbing and murdering. They're just totally corrupt. And you need a hired gun to clean out the town. And that's what we've got today. This is the type of story we have, where the leaders go and find a hired gun to clean out the town. And so we'll be using that picture today as we talk about this section of Scripture. All right, so what are we going to do today? I just want to review a little bit from last week. Then I'll split it into five parts. Part one is going to be a job description, and that's from 10:17. If you've got a vacancy and you've got to write an ad for the job, you need to have a decent sort of description. I'll come back to that and I'll show you. I'll blow it up later on. You can read what it is. Secondly, once you've got a job description, you come to a point where you've got a candidate for the job. And so we'll look at the candidate in 11, 1 and 2. Let's just pause. Can you read that? I'll read through it for those who are only on audio. It's Alice is with her boss, and a boss comes to her and says, "Alice, I want you to interview a job candidate for me. Let me know what you think." And so there's Alice in the second screen interviewing the job candidate. And her question, and I've asked these to some people, "Why did you leave your last job?" And his reply, "I punched the boss." So third slide, Alice goes back to the boss and says, He's exactly who we need. Some of you get that. All right, going to... can someone, Tim, can you duck up and turn off the front lights for me, please? Thanks, mate. Part three. We're going to look at the actual interview and the offer that goes, oh, there he is. I lost him for a minute. I thought you went invisible, Andy, put on a camouflage shirt or something. Thank you. Part three, the interview and the offer, and that's 11:4-6. Then in part four, we'll look at the salary package that they negotiate, and that's verses 7-10. Important to look at the salary package when you offered a job. And then finally, in part five, we'll look at the induction, which is in chapter 11, verse 11. Okay, so you get the feel of where we're going with this today. All right, let's just go back. What did we talk about last week? We had a couple of minor judges. Minor judges because we only had basically one verse on them each. Didn't get a lot of information. We had Tola, remember? He was down there in Ephraim, but he was from Issachar. But it says that the Lord raised him up to deliver the people. And this is part of what we've seen in this study. We'll see a slide in a minute of the cycle of events that happens in Israel. And there's a strong point about this judge, that he followed on after Abimelech, sometime after Abimelech. We don't know when. But he was raised up by God to deliver Israel. We don't know from whom he delivered Israel, so we don't have much information. We then had Jair, and Jair was interesting because we associated that with the donkeys. We made the point that we probably don't hold donkeys in high regard, but I think we have a donkey vote we often talk about. So it's not a compliment. If you are a donkey voter, it's not a compliment. But Jair had 30 sons. He had 30 who rode on 30 donkeys. They control 30 towns. And they are in the area of Gad, which was on the east of the Jordan. And the suggestion with this man, Jair, is that there's no comment about how God raised him up. But the comment tends to be more about how Jair pursued his own interests and his own ambitions. So there was not a real spiritual content on the part of Jair. There's the map there. There's Issachar up in that area there, Ephraim down here. That was where our first judge was. And then this one is over here in Gad. And just while I'm at it, here's the Ammonites over here. Gilead is this area to the east of the Jordan. We think probably that Jephthah came from Gad, but he went across to Tob over here past the Ammonites, and that was where he was when the leaders came to speak to him. With Jephthah, we saw last week, the thing about this, the introduction we had about Jephthah last week, is this issue of apostasy. Again, Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And they listed seven groups of gods. Seven. Holding up my five fingers there. I'm not from Tumarumba, that's just five. There were seven groups of gods. But what was it was saying? It was telling you how apostate Israel had become. They were on this downward spiral. And later on in the narrative, God talks about how he rescued them from seven groups of people. And yet, Israel has gone apostate again and says to the Lord, well, dig us out of our hole. And he says, well, why don't you get the gods you're worshipping to dig you out of the hole? And so what we have in our cycle is a block in the cycle. This is what you normally get with the judges. Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord. Therefore, God disciplines them. Israel will serve a foreign entity for a period of time. In this case, it refers to serving the Ammonites for 18 years. Israel then cries out for relief from their pain. And then what usually happens is that God delivers someone, a judge, that will release, and God's spirit will be on that judge, and the oppressor is subdued. And then the land has rest. But last week, we only got down to about here, and God basically is putting a block with that statement. Go and ask the gods that you're worshipping to dig you out of your hole. And so we have a block there. And there's no comment given. It just goes on and tells us the first verse we read today, what's the situation with the Ammonites? And we came to the conclusion last week. We said, for us, do we want to be like the Israelites and just want God to perform at our command? Is that what we want? We treat God like a genie. Oh, I've got a problem. Rub the genie. Genie comes out. Yes, what is it you want? Boom, problem solved. Do we want God to perform just at our command? Do we treat him like a genie? See, what Israel was doing, they were saying, we've got a problem. God, I want you to fix it right now. And we had that challenge. Are we like that? Do we have a problem and expect that we're just going to snap our fingers and God's going to solve our problem right now? And do we put conditions on that? Solve that problem, Lord, now, or I'm out of here. You don't solve my problem, I'm not coming to church next Sunday. I'm not going to put money in the offering. In fact, I'm resigning from the roster. Which, by the by, there are some spaces on the roster. I will take volunteers. God, fix it right now or I'm out of here. Are we like that sometimes? And that was some of the challenges that we were left with last week. And we were reminded of ourselves of this one. You cannot manipulate God. That's what the Israelites were trying to do. You cannot turn our back on him and then just expect when we snap our fingers, he's going to just accede to our every little request. That's where we left it last week. All right, just before we go on, I just want to remind you again of the bigger picture where we're going here. So that chapter 10 through to chapter 12, verse 7, in fact, there are five sections. And that's what last week we looked at. The first section, Israel and Yahweh, or Israel and God, 10, 6 to 16. And in each of these sections, there's a dialogue. Last week, it was between a God and Israel. Today, in the second section, we're going to look at the Ammonite threat. That was the section we read, 10, 17 to 11, 11. And there's a dialogue in there. There's a dialogue between the leaders of Gilead and Jephthah. And just quickly, there'll be a third section. There's Jephthah versus the Ammonite king. See some interesting communication there. The fourth section details the Ammonite defeat. And then fifthly, Jephthah has an issue with the Ephraimites. So that's where we're going with this. All right, so let's go back to part one. The job description. The elders of the town, or the leaders of the town. Now, and Gilead incidentally covers an area to the east of Jordan. It covers the area of Gad, but it also includes a bit of Reuben, and I think it also extends further up into Manasseh as well. And so they use this term, the leaders of Gilead. But I'm assuming, from what I can gather, that Jephthah is from the tribe of Gad. So, see our picture again. In the Westerns, the town council gets together. You know, these blokes who are the politicians. Usually sneaky, slimy sort of blokes, bit overfed, and they're getting together. We've got a problem. What are we going to do? and all looking at each other to solve the problem. For those of you who didn't get the slide before, they have a problem, so we need to find someone to solve this problem. And they're talking about it amongst themselves. Whoever will lead us against the Ammonites, that person can be the head of us. And you can see this. Well, are you going to do it? What about you? Well, no, I can't do it. You know, I've got a ranch to run. What about you? No, I've got to run the store. But they know they need a hired gun. The advertisement says, piano player wanted, must have knowledge of opening clams. Don't write your ad like that, is what I would suggest to you. They needed to get the right person for the job. And so they were looking for a gunslinger. But the way it comes out in the scripture, it's a political solution. Notice there's no sense of coming before the Lord, coming before him in a sense of humility and in seeking his will. They got together to manufacture this solution through what politicians do. They horse trade, don't they? They trade. You give me this, I'll give you that sort of thing. So there was no real spiritual input. So their answer, they needed a gunslinger. So they were going to then work out how to do it. So we go to part two, the candidate. And that's in chapter 11, verses 1 to 3. Who do they choose for this gunslinger? This man Jephthah, he's talked about as a mighty warrior, 11 verse 1, if you notice that, he's a mighty warrior. That is not a compliment. What's a gunslinger do? Gunslinger is usually someone who will do things that you won't do. He'll go and do what is necessary. He does the dirty jobs. Indeed, he's probably on the edge of the law. And so in some cases, if necessarily, he'll go criminal. The fact that he's a mighty warrior, which indeed was the same description of Abimelech, means that he was a rough fellow. If he wasn't a criminal, he was certainly on the edge of that. So this is the person they looked at. And they described Jephthah. Jephthah, of course, was an outcast, apart from the fact of what he may have done, but he was an outcast because of his birth. His mother was a prostitute, not a high-ranking member of society. And so his brothers, or his half-brothers in fact, decided he's not suitable to hang around us. He doesn't get any of the inheritance. Now we think what happened is that Jephthah's father probably adopted him, right? Made him an official member of the family, partly for that reason, so he could have an inheritance and be part of the family. We think that what's happened is that Jephthah's father, Gilead, has died. And at that stage, the other brothers contest the will. I know that comes as a shock to some of you, but in some families, people contest the will. And they basically have gone to the leaders and said, this bloke should not have any part of the inheritance. And the leaders of Gad agreed with that. Indeed, I suspect that maybe some of the leaders of Gad were his brothers. And so it was, mate, there's nothing for you here. Off you go. And they drove him out. It's a story you see in the Westerns quite often, in fact. The person is driven out of that town. And so it gives us a little bit of a biography. It sort of looks back as to what happened with Jephthah. He was driven out. And he went to the land of Tob. And like happens in the Westerns, where does the person go when they're driven out? They go to the bad lands, you know, rough country. And it says he had around him a band of adventurers. You know, like some benign backpackers just wandering around? Think not. other people who were outcasts, other people who were outlaws, in fact. And he's got them together and they've formed a band. And I suspect that they're not just sitting around playing cards all day, every day. They're going out probably raiding places. So this is who Jephthah is. He's not the sort of person you will invite home for dinner to meet your family. If you see him coming down the street, you'd probably disappear. He'd been disinherited. What happens when people are disinherited? Sometimes they are very ambitious. And there's whole stories all through history of people who are incredibly ambitious because they want to get back their inheritance and in fact prove that they really are somebody of substance. Comes to mind people like Henry II of England. Henry II of England, when his father died, I think he was Henry I. Henry I, I think he died from eating bad fish. So take that as you will. But what happened, Henry II's cousin, Stephen, hot-footed it from France across to England, grabbed hold of the treasury and basically, therefore, had the kingdom. Henry's mother, Matilda, fought very hard for her son and she basically defeated Stephen, but they came to an agreement that Stephen would continue to be king, but his son would not become king, rather it would be Henry would become king. And Henry was very, very ambitious. And if you know your history of that time, from about the 1150s, 1170s or so, he owned a huge swathe of what is now France, partly because his wife was Eleanor of Aquitaine, who had much, much land as a result of her inheritances. But there's lots of stories of people who have been disinherited and they become very ambitious. So we think this person is probably very ambitious. But he certainly was not good enough. That's why he was driven out. And so you can see the tension. You've got a group of people saying, you're not good enough. You're not good enough to be in our town. And the person himself trying to prove that he is good enough. So you have that tension going on. Again, just that comment, he was noted as a mighty warrior, right? Not a complimentary term. But one of the things that the leaders noticed is that they thought he'd be available for their little plan. Now, when you've got a job vacancy and you go headhunting somebody, it's a good idea to sort of suss out whether they're going to be available or not. So we think he was available. And the good thing about it is he already had a team in place. So he could bring his team to solve the problem. So that's where we are with the candidate. I would call him even a bushranger. So part three, let's look at the interview and the offer in verses 4 to 6. These politicians go to him and they try to get him on the cheap because they go to him and say, come and be our commander. And that word's significant because back in 1017, they said, whoever will fight the Ammonites will be our head. Now they're offering to be our commander. There's a difference. And it's like this. If he was going to be their head, they would offer him the position of sheriff. Come in and be our sheriff and run the town how you like. But they're not offering him that. They're offering him to be the deputy sheriff. So he's not really going to be in charge. They try to get him on the cheap. Maybe this is the art of the deal. If you're going to thinking, well, we need this person for our organisation. We're prepared to pay him $100,000. Let's offer him $60,000. And maybe we'll trade and he'll take 80. That's a win-win. He thinks he's got a win. We've got a win because we've reduced our price. But definitely they were trying to do it on the cheap. There was no sense of them coming here and saying, we believe that God has nominated you for this job. There's no sense of that. They're just going to hire a gunslinger to sort out their mess. That's what they're doing. So they offer him the deputy sheriff job. So it's a political deal. So there's no real spiritual input. There's no sense from the believers, from the leaders, that we believe that, that God is sending us to you to raise this issue, that we believe that God has chosen you for this job. So they give him the lesser offer. But the offer's not good enough. And so we'll see in part four the counteroffer, verses 7 to 10. What Jephthah does, he plays hard to get. Now that's important in a job interview. Don't want to say, oh, when can you start? Oh, I can start straight away. What does that say? He hasn't got a job. He's desperate. Well, I don't know. I've got a lot of commitments to be able to put aside, and I really like to finish the project I'm on. People have got to want you to come. They've got to think that you're really something special. And Jephthah really puts it back in their face. And what he says, look at that verse 7. Just notice that. Jephthah says to them, didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble? Why should I come and help you? It's a little bit like the conversation between God and Israel in the last chapter. You're asking me for help. Why don't you ask the gods that you were worshipping? And that's similar sort of idea. Why are you asking me for help, says Jephthah? You chucked me out. Come on, you've got to give me some incentive to come. And so they need to up the offer. And in verse 8, the elders say, nevertheless, we're turning to you. Now come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be our head over all of Gilead. So the parties are in this stage of haggling, like two stags pushing backwards and forwards. Jephthah's not kindly disposed towards these people. And if he's going to come, there needs to be something really substantial that they give him. But ultimately, the leaders make a fair offer. Notice what they say in this verse. Come and be our head. And so they're saying to him, yeah, come and be the sheriff. You can run the town how you like, and we'll give you accommodation. We'll provide a cleaning service. You're going to have free coffee at the cafe. We'll give you a discount card at the butcher's, and so on. We'll pay for all your ammunition. They've upped the offer to something reasonable. And so it's now a fair offer. But Jephthah, in that sense, doesn't say, I believe that God is calling me to come to this job. You don't see that. He does invoke the name of God, though, in the story. And what he's really saying is, in verse 9, Jephthah said, suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites and the Lord gives them to me. Will I really be your head? We'd say today, oh, you've made me the offer verbally. Put it in writing and send it to my solicitor and we'll have a look at it. Are you really going to do this? Now, it seems like that they would make him their head if he actually fought, and the implication is beat the Ammonites. I mean, if he didn't beat the Ammonites, well, it's all academic, isn't it? He's probably going to be dead. There's not much to lead if the people from Gad get beaten by the Ammonites. But so there's this assumption. If I do this, are you really going to make me your head? And he's putting the pressure on them. I want it in writing, and my lawyer and my solicitor will look it over. And the elders of Gilead replied, "The Lord is our witness. We will do as you say." And they invoke God's name in this. The Lord is our witness. And from what we've seen of Israel, I'm not sure how serious this is and how genuine, or is it just going through the motions? But they make the deal. It's a little bit, seems to me, like some things that people do. It's like people who are non-believers but get married in a church and make these vows before God. They're going through the motions. They may be serious about it, but it's a bit odd to be making a vow before the Lord when you're not even a believer. So we're not sure just how serious these leaders are in terms of their commitment to the Lord. But they're going through the motions. They're following the form. But they make the deal. And so that in part 5, they go back for the induction in verse 11. And you can see the situation, that he comes back to the town at some stage, whether he comes back with them straight away or whether there's a period where they've negotiated. I don't know when these negotiations took place. It was just sometime during when the Ammonites were annoying them. Remember, they were probably coming up every year for 18 years. I'm not sure we're at the 18-year mark when they first negotiated. It may have been partway through there. We don't know how long the negotiations took. But they come back and you can see the thing. The whole town's there. And the mayor's there. And he's going to pin the badge on Jephthah, and he will pin it on very carefully so he doesn't stick it in him, of course. But they're there, carefully pinning the badge on. And you can see all the towns there. And there's this ceremony, simple but moving, to induct him in as the sheriff. And standing behind him, of course, is his team with their rifles and shotguns and scowling at the people, as is the case, as is what you have to do. And so he has an oath of office. And in terms of the story, that's as far as we're going this week. So his rank's pinned on, there he is there with his badge. But again, largely it's political. We don't get that strong sense from Jephthah that this is God's will for me. What's my conclusion here? Here's a question for all of us. What drives me? What sort of ambition do I have? Nothing wrong with having ambition. Nothing wrong with having goals. But that ambition can be what I would call a blind ambition. And the suspicion with Jephthah, as he really wants to put the boot into these other people. He wants to prove to himself and everyone that he is really somebody and he's worthwhile. Motives do matter. One of the things you see with people is they have this ambition to be in a certain, to be a certain position, and perhaps in the army, if I can give an example. A person who says, by 45, I want to be a colonel. The interesting thing about that you find with some of those people is back in the early days, and that's going to take a minimum of about 20 years in our system, they're a lieutenant. And you note the correct pronunciation is lieutenant with the Australian Army. The person who's still a lieutenant has this goal up here to be a colonel. And that's okay. But some of them don't care about the job they're doing. It's just a stepping stone to where they want to go. They have no interest really in the people or the job that they're doing. And all they're worried about is getting their right postings and doing their courses so that they can become a captain. Again, don't care what job they do, so long as it gets them to their next step and so on. And that's what I mean by blind ambition. So motives matter. How you do the job today, now. Someone said, God trusts us. If he can't trust you with the little things, how can he trust you with the big things? And so it's not your rank that matters. Some people have this idea that it's their rank or their position that means they're successful. I'd say it's better be the best rather than the biggest, is what I've written on the screen. Be the best rather than the biggest. Be the best rather than having the high position. If you have a high position, no, I have no problem. There's nothing wrong with that. But whatever job you're doing, seek to be the best you can at that job. Number three, so number one was what drives me. Number two, be the best, not the biggest. And number three, that brings me to the point, you have to have both competence and character in a job. The two go together. Imagine this. Like on the Westerns, you've just got into the stagecoach and you're about to go out. And the driver comes along, climbs up. G'day, how you going? Oh, he's a really nice bloke, you know him. He's ethical, treats his wife well, he's compassionate, his kids are well trained. It says please and thank you. Great bloke, good man to be around. And then he says, oh, does anyone know how to drive these? I've never done this before. I think you'd probably get out, wouldn't you? In case you don't realise it, driving a team of horses is pretty skillful. Rod Baker's not here today to tell me about that, right? But talk to Rod. I can't do anything with horses. So to me, I wouldn't do it. It's not like the movies, like in the aeroplane, where someone doesn't know how to fly an aeroplane and in an emergency manages to land it. Same deal. If your pilot or your driver is incompetent, no matter how good a person is, you don't want him. But on the other hand, our stagecoach driver, he's very competent. He's fantastic. But halfway along, he gets sick of it. Oh, I think I'd rather go to the pub. He just jumps off and lets it go. Well, the pilot just decides to bail out. You need both competence and you need character as well. You need those two things in everything you're doing. So let's be challenged to whatever job we're doing. Let's be doing it the best we can with both competence and character. And you don't always do the job well to start with. You have to learn to do your job as well. And so those of us in leadership, and then any situation where you're, when you're one of the leaders, you have to take that into account with your staff. I want to leave it there. There's some challenges for you. And then next week we'll pick up with the story with the Ammonites and Jephthah.